Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, live in New York. Happy Father's Day. This is Reliable Sources, where we examine the story behind the story, and we figure out what's reliable. This hour, the January 6th hearings are highlighting the democracy beat. We're gonna look at why some newsrooms are adding editors and reporters to this key post. Plus, YouTube has a big election misinformation policy, but is it backfiring? Reasons, Robbie Suave is here with that. And as the US commemorates Juneteenth, a fresh perspective about race and education. The author of that book, Ibram X. Kendi, will join me. We will also pay tribute to the late, great Mark Shields. His daughter, Amy, will join me live. But first, the U.S. media's narrative about President Biden. It might seem like the Biden administration is facing a perfect storm right now with regards to rising inflation, sky-high gas prices, the continued COVID pandemic, the president's unpopularity in the polls, and more columnists and commentators are bringing up Biden's age as a factor as well. Right now, some liberals see a pile-on going on. Conservatives think others are just catching up to where they've been all along about Biden. Even standard photo ops seem to be going sideways for Biden right now. Of course, the news media shapes these narratives, chooses what video to show, maybe warps these narratives. Biden's relative lack of interviews with the media has also been a sore spot. If you ask White House reporters, you'll hear those complaints. This week, he invited a reporter from the Associated Press into the Oval Office for a 30-minute interview. It was a rare move, as some of these headlines said, and there are a long list of media outlets still waiting for a turn with the president. But there was a lot of news in that interview, so let's talk about it and a whole lot more with Julie Pace. She's the executive editor of the Associated Press. Also here with me, Danielle Belton, the editor-in-chief of the pioneering digital news source HuffPost, and John Harwood, a veteran of The Wall Street Journal and CNBC, now a White House correspondent here at CNN. Welcome to everybody. Lots to talk about. Julie, this Associated Press interview with Biden, this was the AP's first interview with Biden. It's been basically a year and a half. What took so long, and why do you think he spoke to your reporter now?
Well, it's a good question why it took so long. We certainly wish we could have had a chance to interview the president sooner, but we're very appreciative of the opportunity to do so this past week. Look, I think there are a few reasons why the White House decided to give Josh Boak, our terrific White House economics reporter, this interview. One is exactly what I just said. Josh is an economics-focused reporter, and this is a moment when the White House realizes that economics, the way that people are feeling about their own personal economic situation, that is probably the most urgent situation facing voters heading into the November elections. And they looked to the Associated Press, a news organization that really speaks to a lot of Americans who are not following the daily twists and turns of politics. They are not following, you know, all the back and forth on Capitol Hill or on a lot of, you know, political punditry shows, but they are very attuned to what is happening in their own lives. So I think this was an attempt by Biden to reach out to some of those voters to make clear that he understands some of the frustrations that they are feeling and to go with a reporter who is very steeped in economic policy, who knows it inside and out.
And there was quite a bit of news in the interview. I was reading it for hints about his media diet, his references to reading the New York Times Magazine. You can sense in some cases the president's frustration with the news media. John Harwood, have you picked up on that from your post at the White House as well?
Oh, there's no question. I think the Biden White House thinks that all of the coverage is unduly negative, that he's getting blamed for inflation when at best it's only partly attributable to administration policies. And, you know, it's part of the difficulty that any modern president has in communicating. There is so much media, there's so much media criticism that it's very, very difficult for a White House to set a clear communication strategy and see it break through to the American people. So many sources of information online, on television, other means. So, yes, they're quite frustrated right now.
Well, on this Father's Day, your dad, John, was the first ombudsman at a major American paper, the Washington Post. So your father was a media critic. That was in the 70s. It's an unimaginable media environment compared to today. So where are Biden's critiques of the media legitimate? Where are they justified? And where would you say they're not justified?
Well, look, let's talk about the age thing to begin with.
Let's put up Mark Leibovich's column. Mark Leibovich, you know, top writer for The Atlantic, saying Biden should not run for re-election. It's not just Sean Hannity talking about Biden's age. It's The Atlantic magazine.
That's right. And it was an outstanding piece by Mark. Without taking a stand on whether he's too old to run for re-election, let me just run through what's true, what's false, and what gets conflated. What is true is the presidency's a hugely taxing job mentally and physically. And Joe Biden is old. He doesn't talk or walk as smoothly as he once did. That suggests challenges. And when you get into your 80s, which he's about to do, the risk of health problems grows with every year. On the other hand, what's false is that he is not capable of doing the job right now, or he's not mentally in tune with the demands of the job. Anybody, any aide who engages with him or reporters, we can see this. The gears of his mind are working. That's an issue pushed by right-wing media, but it's not correct. And what gets conflated is this. President Biden is in a weak political position right now, and because he's old, people think he's weak because he's old. His biggest political problem right now is $5 a gallon gas. Right. Gas is not $5 a gallon because Joe Biden's old. His legislative program is not stymied in Congress because Joe Biden is old. It's because he's got a 50-50 Senate, and one of the members of that Democratic Senate comes from a Trump plus 39 state. I think the other thing that we should point out is that younger, more vibrant presidents like Bill Clinton, Barack Obama also had tremendous political problems in their second years, got hammered in midterm elections, and they ended up politically healthier. So Joe Biden would look a little bit younger if he was at 50% than at 40%, but he's not. And so he's going to have to deal with these stories for some time.
But all of that context you're providing, John, is that an argument, Danielle, that the president needs to be given a lot more interviews in order to tell that story?
Well, I mean, he just has to. Like, for example, I would love to have him at HuffPost. We'd love to talk to him about anything he'd like to talk about. The reality is, not talking doesn't solve anything. Like, you cannot talk and you can prove that you're not willing to fight, and then you can lose the midterms and then possibly even lose in 2024. You have to maintain being proactive. You have to be aggressive. You have to stay out there. Because it's not like, yes, he's very blunt and gaffe prone. Like, that's the reality. But not talking doesn't change the reality. Not talking just makes him not part of the news cycle, not part of the story,
right,
not controlling the narrative.
And I like the reality about what Biden can control and cannot control. He can control how much he communicates or not. He cannot control, and John Harwood, this is a point you made in one of your CNN.com columns, he cannot control the Fed actions or the minutia of inflation. You pointed out in one of your columns, the Fed doesn't have daily press briefings, but the White House does. So maybe the White House gets more blame about economic problems than it actually deserves. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, in terms of this particular economic problem. It is fair to say that Joe Biden's fiscal policy at the beginning of the administration may have exacerbated the problem of inflation. It did not create the problem of inflation. There are many factors that went into that, including supply shocks from the pandemic, loose monetary policy from the Federal Reserve, the war in Ukraine, all of that. The economy springing back to life from the pandemic, that in itself made demand surge, and the government had put a lot of money in people's pockets. So that's a legitimate criticism. On the other hand, the Federal Reserve is the steward of monetary policy. That's the most important way of controlling inflation. And Joe Biden, as the face of the American government, gets asked every single day, what's your strategy on inflation? What's your message on inflation? There aren't too many good answers for that. And the president has to come up with some answers. And we're going to be dealing with this all the way through the election because inflation's going to be with us through then. But the idea that any president of the United States, for example, can just make gas prices go down is kind of ridiculous.
Right. News coverage needs to reflect that reality, certainly. All right, everyone, stay with me. Let's turn to this week's revelations from the January 6th hearings. And this note from the committee chair.
There are some who think the danger has passed.
The January 6th hearings, the hearings are not just about the past. They are about the present and the future. The creation of a historical record is important, but it may be the least important aspect. Heading off the next coup attempt may matter a lot more. We are seeing specific threats to democracy, to the right to vote. In places like New Mexico, we're seeing conspiracy theories erupt into screams in one county, quote, after false fraud claims threw primary certification into question. These stories are keeping reporters busy the same way rot and mold keeps contractors busy. And some newsrooms are taking a stand. Joe Kahn, who became executive editor of the New York Times this week, told NPR's David Folkenflik, you can't have independent journalism in a non-free society. And we are not impartial about whether or not this nation becomes a non-free society. And this week, the Associated Press named Tom Verdon to a new job, democracy editor. So back with Julie Pace here, top editor of the AP. Julie, I've never heard of a democracy news editor before. What's this about?
So this is a really new but also very crucial beat that we are covering at the AP. This is threats to democracy. Yes, in the United States, we'll also be looking at this globally because while this is certainly an issue here at home, this is an issue in a lot of countries around the world. But one of the reasons that I'm particularly excited that Tom Verdon, as you mentioned, has been named to our democracy editor is that Tom's background comes in leading state house coverage at the AP in all 50 states. And I think the challenge that a lot of news organizations are facing when it comes to covering democracy is that, yes, this is, of course, a national issue. It is a macro issue, but it's playing out all across the country in very local ways. And you saw a great example of that in New Mexico, as you pointed out, where you had a rural county with a three-person commission that decided to hold off on certifying election results basically just because they didn't want to certify them. There was no evidence there. And so we have to really get down into the weeds of this at the state and local level, because that's where so many of these decisions are going to be made. And if you think about what happened in New Mexico, potentially playing out across the country in November in the midterm elections or in a general election in 2024, I think it certainly could provide enough fodder to keep a democracy editor and a democracy team quite busy.
Yes, indeed. Danielle, you said to me in an email, this is something the newsrooms have to keep ringing the alarm about. What exactly is the alarm?
The alarm is that we have an extremist wing, an extremist element within the conservative movement that is trying to basically take over the Republican Party. Like, this is happening in Idaho already. Chris Mathias, one of our reporters here at HuffPost, has chronicled in depth what has been going on in Idaho, where you have outsiders coming into the state to try to influence local elections, to try to elect more extremist people with more extremist views. And just recently, you had 31 white nationalists who were arrested with intent to riot at a Pride event. And that's what we're up against. We're up against a small minority of people.
When you say we're up against, who's we?
The press.
The American people.
The American people, all of us. Huh. Anyone who is pro-democracy, pro-free press, pro-equality, like, this is what we're up against, because these are the things these people do not want. They don't want to see a free and equitable society. They don't want to see a place where someone like me is leading a newsroom at HuffPost. They don't want to see women in positions of power or people of color in positions of power, or to see gay people and trans people live freely and openly. Like, that's what we are up against. If you are for freedom, if you are for equality, you have to take a stance. And that's why it's so important for the press to keep banging the drum. This is not the time to be shy. This is not the time to demur away from something. This is not the time to just both sides something to death. There is no both sides to whether or not you're pro-democracy and pro-free press.
We should report the truth. And let me show this headline at the same time, though. Here's some truth. A Fox News poll that says more Republicans. So here's the headline. It says Republicans are more likely to preserve democracy than Democrats. So if you ask the American people who's more likely to save democracy, you're going to get Republicans over Democrats by like about 1%. But the point, John Harwood, is there's a divide on that question as well. So all the talk about democracy and extremism in the Republican Party, a lot of people don't see it that way at all.
Well, sure. And people answering that question may interpret the support of democracy as meaning that their side wins. But I think, as Danielle indicated, we've got to make sure, as reporters, that we have the right language for this moment. the traditional way that we cover political disputes in Congress, for example, is Democrats on one side, Republicans on the other. The spectrum is liberal to conservative, and we should not take sides on liberal versus conservative. However, this situation, the Trump era more generally, but this particular situation, that's not the spectrum. The spectrum is truth on the one side and lies on the other side. And a large chunk of the Republican Party has chosen to situate itself on the lying end of that spectrum. Donald Trump has, of course, been there for a long time, but many Republicans are now echoing his lies. And when we see what the January 6th committee is laying out, not partisan in the slightest, Republican witnesses, Republican questioners, Republican members like Liz Cheney leading the divide, we can't shrink from identifying who's on the truth side and who's on the lying side. That is a choice that Republicans, many Republicans have made, and we in the press are not indifferent to that. We should take sides in that. We are for the truth, and we've got to say so.
Julie Pace, last word to you.
I agree that we absolutely need to be advocates for the truth, for facts. I do think as a challenge to all of my colleagues in the media, one of the things we need to keep trying to do is explain what the truth is, to do it in language that people can understand, to do it in ways that help try to break through some of these bubbles that people live in. I think that that's a pursuit that is really noble, and I hope that we all continue to do it.
Julie Pace, Danielle Belton, and John Harwood, thank you all for the conversation. Up next here, why did YouTube take down a video published by the 1-6 House Committee? Robbie Suave is standing by with reaction to that. And later, a galactic battle for your attention. We're going to show you how big tech rivals are trying to out-tick and out-talk TikTok.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back. More of former President Trump's lies about the 2020 election will be on full display on Capitol Hill this week. There will be more hearings by the January 6th committee, more presentations of multimedia clips during the public hearings. YouTube removed one of those videos from the platform this week because the presentation included a clip of one of Trump's lies about 2020. The New York Times captured this screenshot with the video that says this video is private. You can't watch it on YouTube. So why? That's because the platform owned by Google Alphabet shifted its election misinfo policy a month after the 2020 election. YouTube announced a blanket ban on content that includes lies about the election without, quote, proper context, regardless of who creates it. Is that the right policy? Let's bring in Robbie Suave, senior editor at Reason Magazine, the Libertarian Bible. He also hosts a YouTube show for The Hill that was suspended in March under the same policy. Robbie, so this policy, can you explain it to viewers? Because I think it's quite confusing.
It is quite confusing. I think people don't fully understand what YouTube's policy is that if you're showing the claim that Trump's made, the false claims he's made about the election, unless you immediately in that same video correct it or you have a disclaimer in it, then they're counting that whole video as spreading misinformation, even if it's clear that, you know, it's not you, the producer of the video, saying that. You're simply calling attention to it, which is obviously a legitimate function of journalism, of this committee. Yeah, the same thing happened to my YouTube show, Rising. We played a clip of Trump. It's a news show saying that he said this. It was clear we did not endorse that claim. My viewers know I don't endorse that claim. I've rejected that claim on any number of occasions. But because I didn't immediately do so in the video, they counted that as spreading misinformation. Spreading awareness of misinformation is not the same thing as spreading misinformation itself. And YouTube, I think, should figure that out. It's really lunacy that they haven't.
Here's the company's statement. Let's put it on screen. Our election integrity policy prohibits content advancing false claims that widespread fraud, errors, or glitches change the outcome of the election. If it does not provide sufficient context, we enforce our policies equally for everyone, and that's why we've removed the video from the committee. Gosh, I really think this has been eye-opening, though. It was eye-opening when it happened to you at the Hill. It's eye-opening for the committee. I think this makes people think twice about their relationship to these big tech platforms.
Yeah, and look, there's a lot of misinformation out there, but I think the efforts to absolutely moderate it in all cases can go overboard, and this is a good case of that. What if Trump was speaking and it was being covered live by some outlet on YouTube? What about C-SPAN? Is YouTube going to take the position that every claim has to be vetted in real time? Right now, they're only saying it's election misinformation and then some specific COVID claims. But as we know, Brian, some claims about efficacies of certain, what the vaccines do, what masks work, the knowledge of that changes over time. Different recommendations come out. So the idea that they would have some blanket ban on in any one circumstance on just those subjects, it seems very weird to me. I think it might give people the idea that everything on YouTube is being vetted, because if that wasn't true, they would take it down. And that would be even more confusing to people.
We'd love to have a YouTube executive on to talk about this. All right, I'd love to know your take on the coverage of 1/6 this week, Robbie. We talked here last week about Fox News not showing the first hearing, the primetime hearing. The two hearings this week were shown live by Fox News, and something interesting happened in the ratings, maybe something predictable. The ratings cratered. Fox viewers basically turned off the TV when the hearings were on and then turned Fox back on when the hearings were over. Of course, the ratings were seen in MSNBC, both increased dramatically during the hearings. So I think we can take away from that the same thing new ABC polling is showing. The Republicans are a lot less interested in watching these hearings. What have you noticed about right-wing media coverage this week?
Yeah, I mean, they don't want to talk about it, and they should, because it's legitimate news, and the job is to cover the news, and that should be true whether you're ostensibly liberal or ostensibly conservative. But I do think it gets at a broader truth, which is that no one new is being won over or persuaded by any of this. Every person in the country has made up their mind about Trump and his culpability or lack thereof, depending on your perspective, in what happened at the Capitol. And I don't have any confidence that new revelations in this committee hearing are going to move the ball on that whatsoever. We broadly already know what happened. We know Trump said things that weren't true and then stoked a mob that did what we all saw, this horrible. And then he was almost removed from office for it, but he was acquitted. I mean, what else can we do? What else can we learn about it? And you're not going to bring more Americans, I don't think, more Americans who haven't already made their mind on Trump. Is there such a person? Isn't everyone on the side they figured out by now? And I think the risk of actually undercovering what people, independent and moderate people who've not made up their minds about who they would vote for next time based on inflation, the economy, those things. That's I'm not saying the January 6th committee doesn't. It certainly matters and should be covered. But I think people have already decided how they feel about it. And there are a lot of other issues that certainly merit attention that people haven't totally made up their mind about yet.
So a related story and one of the most interesting media stories of the week was about this place, about CNN, and that's what we cover here. So let's put up on screen the Mediaite headline about CNN. New CNN boss wants staff to stop calling Trump's election claims the big lie. So that headline, I would say it's a little more nuanced than that. Let me quote from it. It says, on a Tuesday conference call, CNN CEO Chris Licht was asked for his thoughts about the big lie, and he said he preferred that staff avoid the term. He made clear this was a preference. According to a source, Licht argued that the big lie makes the mistake of adopting branding from the Democratic Party, thereby weakening the objectivity of the network. I thought this was a fascinating inside the newsroom debate. All of a sudden, it has become public and it's been distorted by some people. But what's your read on this? Rethinking the phrase, the big lie.
I mean, I think I probably agree, at least partly, with your boss here. I mean, the big lie is also not specific, right? Unless you're extremely plugged in to what you're talking about. I know what you're talking about when you refer to that. But maybe the average person doesn't. I mean, in fact, there are any number of lies, of claims Trump has made that are lies, even prior to the election. It could be referring to that. Is it the biggest lie even of our lifetimes, of the political news cycle? Wouldn't that be weapons of mass destruction or something going back to the Bush era? So I think Trump election lies is a more accurate way to describe it anyway. But, you know, we should just talk about it and probably not get overly obsessed with what the right language is. And, you know, independent commentators should make that own judgment for themselves, certainly.
Did you notice what happened over the weekend? Twice now in speeches, Trump has basically lied about this. In Mediaite's word, he lied about CNN's use of the big lie by saying it was a mandate when it was not. So that actually just illustrates the challenge, the conundrum. It's what we've been talking about for 7 years, Robbie, the challenge of covering Donald Trump.
And we have to be very careful how and when and where we talk about it on social media because of their misguided policies for how we discuss these things.
Hey, before I let you go, Stephen Colbert's production team up on Capitol Hill, some of the crew members arrested because they were in these House hallways, apparently banging on doors. On Fox, this was treated like an actual insurrection. What do you think is the real story here, if there is one?
Right. My understanding is they weren't participating in that. Look, the work of journalism is important and should not be thwarted by the state. I always want to call attention whenever we're even tangentially talking about threats to the press, that a grave threat to the press right now.
Even a comedy show?
Is Julian Assange the U.S. government's attempt to extradite? Got to get that out there. It's bad and it should be ended. But yeah, even a comedy show should enjoy, you know, comedy does important journalism work and tell important truths and absolutely deserves any other kind of the same protection we're all getting that all people deserve, really.
And there's a lot more to this Colbert story. I want to know more about the charges. Hopefully more will come out in the days ahead. Thank you, Robbie. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Coming up here, brand new reporting from D.C. Big tech descending on Congress. We're going to tell you what they are lobbying against. Plus, on this Juneteenth, wise words from one of America's best-selling anti-racism authors. Ibram X. Kendi is standing by. Big tech is fighting for control. Tech giants are trying to thwart a bipartisan bill called the American Innovation and Choice Act. It's an antitrust bill led by Senators Amy Klobuchar and Chuck Grassley, targeting huge tech companies like Google and Amazon. Supporters say this bill has the votes needed to pass both chambers of Congress. So will it? What's going on? Joining me now, CNN tech reporter Brian Fung and a CNN alum, now the creator economy reporter at The Information, Kaya Yuryev. Welcome to you both. Brian, what have you learned about tech CEOs coming to D.C.?
Well, we know that the tech industry has been engaged in a massive lobbying campaign to try to defeat this bill and prevent it from becoming law. Google's CEO is going to be on the Hill this coming week to meet with lawmakers. Comes just after Apple's CEO Tim Cook was on the Hill a couple weeks ago. We also know that Amazon's CEO has been calling lawmakers directly to make his case on this bill. And, you know, why is this happening now, and why is it important? Two reasons. One, lawmakers that are supporting the bill are trying to engage in a last-minute push to get this bill through with a Senate floor vote. As you know, the Senate has just a limited amount of time this summer to pass legislation before the August recess, and then we come back and it'll be the midterms. Second, you know, this bill really drives at the heart of the business models of some of these companies, which is why they're, you know, so dead set on fighting it.
Is it fair to say, Kaya, that this bill is just one of many problems the tech companies have right now?
It definitely is. I think it's a major problem because basically at the heart of this bill is they want tech companies to stop favoring their own products over rivals. So Google, which owns YouTube, wouldn't be able to prioritize YouTube videos and search results, for example, or Apple wouldn't be able to preload its own apps onto iPhones. So definitely a big problem for them. But if you think about the backdrop we're in right now, we have rising inflation, we have an economic downturn, looming recession, which has the potential to impact these ad-driven business models. But I think the big issue is competition. Everyone wants to be TikTok right now, and all these companies are trying to roll out short-form video to compete better with TikTok.
Everybody wants to be TikTok. So what are you seeing? What actions are these companies taking, and why do they want to be TikTok?
Well, I think the problem is the old playbook was buy up these rivals. And they're not able to do that right now with antitrust scrutiny. So their second best option is to copy them. We saw Facebook do that really effectively with Instagram stories, with disappearing posts, which was what Snapchat pioneered. But they haven't been able to do that with short-form video. And I think it's just because TikTok has just captured young people. It's captured the cultural zeitgeist. And it's just far ahead of all these competitors.
Right. So that's the real challenge. And there's been a lot of stories, Brian, lately about TikTok and its ownership and the data that American users have maybe being seen by China. Fill us in on that.
Sure. I mean, I think what we saw this past week was TikTok announcing that it had moved all of its U.S. users' data to a platform owned and operated by Oracle, which goes toward addressing some of the concerns that U.S. national security officials have raised about TikTok's links to China. It is owned by a Chinese company, and the company has really had a hard time trying to address those concerns that, you know, U.S. users' data could be put at risk if the Chinese government were to try to get access to it, for example.
I see. And here's a question I ask every week. What's the latest with Elon Musk and Twitter? Is he still dead set on buying Twitter, Brian?
Well, last week we saw Elon Musk meeting with Twitter's employees. He took questions from them, and he did seem to kind of re-up his interest in owning Twitter. Addressed a number of things ranging from what remote work might look like at the future of the company to what he thinks content moderation should look like. And for Twitter's users, I think the interesting thing is, you know, Musk really doubled down on this idea of, freedom of speech doesn't necessarily mean freedom of reach. He's really kind of explaining that, just because you might be able to say something on Twitter doesn't necessarily mean that Twitter should be able to amplify or should amplify that to a wider audience, which is actually fairly similar to how Twitter operates today.
Right.
Which kind of underscores how, maybe Twitter under Elon Musk might not be all that different after all.
And Kaya, does Musk have TikTok envy too? Does he want to be TikTok also?
I think he does. I mean, we saw him tweet, I think, Friday night about, TikTok being bad for society or kind of posing that question. But he said that he wants Twitter to be a billion user company. And, and TikTok's already achieved that. I mean, all the attention eyeballs are going there. So
they're all going there.
Can't be good for Twitter either.
Thank you both for the conversation. Lots more ahead. We're going to keep covering all this in our nightly Reliable Sources newsletter. Sign up for free at reliablesources.com. Up next, Ibram X. Kendi on what the media is getting wrong about race.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Today marks the second year that the U.S. is celebrating Juneteenth as a federal holiday. It comes amid loud conversations, sometimes at school board meetings, about what is and is not being taught about the nation's history of racism and inequality. These states have placed limits on race education, for example. I spoke with Ibram X. Kendi, founder of the Center for Anti-Racist Research at Boston University. His newest book is titled How to Raise an Anti-Racist. We talked about all of this. One of your primary roles is as educator. So on this Juneteenth, what does white America need to know about the holiday?
I think that if it was, there's so many things that I think white Americans need to know about Juneteenth and really the larger issue of slavery and emancipation, because unfortunately it's just not taught in schools. It's not really engaged with in our political discourse. It's not talked about in the media. But if there's a single idea that white Americans, I hoped, would learn, it's that white people did not save Black people from slavery. Historians are finding that Black people freed themselves through their own resistance, which was really significant in the South seceding from the Union, Black people running from plantations into Union sort of lines, and even into the Union Army, was critical in the turning of the tide of the Civil War.
You say people are not taught that, that students are not taught that. So many of the arguments in the past couple of years have been about what students are or are not learning. Does the media just fundamentally get this coverage wrong?
I think the media is, and I think this is one of the reasons why I even wrote How to Raise an Anti-Racist, because when you have an educational system that rarely has literature on people of color, and you simultaneously rarely talk about racism, and our children are being raised in an inequitable society where certain people with certain skin color are more likely to be impoverished or incarcerated, our kids are being taught that it must not be racism. White people must have more because they are more. And they're literally seeing white people as more in the curriculum, especially over the last 2 years. So it's creating a dangerous situation for our children, which white supremacists, particularly those who are recruiting children online, are exploiting.
And they're exploiting it where? Where do you see that mostly happening?
Well, think about it. If you're a white male teen and no one has explained to you about the ideology of white supremacy, how would you be able to identify it when someone steps, a white supremacist steps into your multiplayer video game, or when they sort of send off a meme that you find sort of funny, or they send you a direct message? You're not going to know that it's white supremacist ideology because no one wants to talk to you about it. No one is educating you about it in your schools.
But so much of the conversation right now is in the opposite direction. It is from the right, from right-wing media saying, get this education out of the schools, make sure it's not taught to kids. What side do you feel is winning right now?
I don't necessarily see it as a sort of a winning or losing. I actually see it as more of a sort of harm and protection. In other words, there are districts in which the minds of children are being harmed because they're not being taught about the beautiful diversity that is the human experience. And then in other school districts, kids are being protected because they're being taught indeed about that diversity, and they're being taught that bad rules are the racial problem and not bad people. And I think that's how we need to be sort of thinking about this. Like, are we truly protecting our children by not engaging with them about those different and other folks as being equal, by not talking to them about racial disparities being the result of racism?
Harm versus protection. That's definitely going to stay with me. Hey, we have a special event here on CNN tonight, Juneteenth, a global celebration for freedom. It starts at 8 p.m. Eastern time right here on the network. Up next here, what Mark Shields taught us about politics. His daughter Amy will join me with reflections on his incredible life. Legendary political analyst Mark Shields died on Saturday. He was 85. Shields was a regular presence here on CNN for nearly two decades, co-hosting Capital Gang, and he was a fixture on the PBS NewsHour for more than three decades. His daughter, Amy Doyle, joins me now. Amy, thank you so much for coming on. I know you and your family are all grieving. What did you know about your father that all of us didn't know? What did you know that the viewing public didn't get to know?
Oh my gosh, there are so many things, Brian. He was an amazing father. He was an amazing husband. But more than anything, I think there's so many fun things about my dad. He was actually very much the same person on television that he was at home. He was very real. He was very honest and open. And he really truly believed in his life to treat everyone equally, as far as, you know, like from the president of the United States to the person pouring coffee or waiting on your table. That's just the kind of person he was. He really believed in that. And I think that's actually fundamentally why he also believes in politics. Oh. So it's just he loved people and he loved politics. I'd say those are the two things about my dad.
What points did he make about politics and campaigns that need to live on?
My dad loved people who ran for office. That was something he always said in his speeches, and he wrote about a lot. Because it's the most ultimate risk you can take, right? like putting yourself out there and potentially probably losing, right? So, and then having it be on the splashed on the cover of the New York Times or the Washington Post the next day. It's he loved that. He loved that risk that people would take and would put themselves out there. And, you know, that was probably, that's the one thing I think of a lot. He also felt that politics was actually important and that it was something that, that basically dueling parties should have conflict, should have conversation, should be able to talk about those things, but not necessarily in the way it's been happening in the past few years.
Right.
I think that's right. What was very different from like your era and mine to my dad's. It's just a different world. And I think that was really difficult for him to deal with because, you know, he grew up in a time when politics was important and people listened to each other. And that is what he definitely wanted to pass on, I know, to the future of, you know, the future political commentators and presidents and congressmen.
And you're a TV producer yourself. We actually happen to be colleagues, both at Warner Brothers Discovery. You make television for a living. Yeah. Do you see connections between your work and his time on TV?
I do. I mean, I think it's storytelling is probably the headline, right? We are both storytellers in different senses. I mean, he was more involved in politics and news. I work for TLC, and we do a lot of shows about a lot of unusual people and families and subcultures and sort of lots of different people. But the theme is storytelling, and it's storytelling for the underdog. I think that's probably the biggest thing that, you know, people, TLC could be, I mean, maybe not everyone thinks of it as underdog television, but it is. It's really actually telling people's stories who wouldn't maybe otherwise be told.
Hmm. I'm really glad that you could come on today and tell us about your dad. And thank you so much for coming on, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a reminder to hold your dads close today and every day. I want to wish a happy Father's Day to everybody watching today, our executive producer, John, and all the dads tuning in. We'll see you right back here this time next week.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.